This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. The EPA was proposed by President Richard Nixon and began operation on December 2nd, 1970, after Nixon signed an executive order. 43 years later, it's become perhaps one of the most controversial cabinet departments, a frequent target of conservatives who call it the arm of federal government overreach. Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott, when asked what does he do for fun, said, "Sue the EPA." But armed with the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Air Act, the EPA has made great strides to manage pollution in America, and it hasn't been easy. It's a story that's been told by Joel A. Mintz. He's the author of Enforcement at the EPA, High Stakes and Hard Choices. Joel Mintz, welcome to The Source.
Thanks very much, David.
And you're invited to join.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Thanks for having us. And so we invite our listeners to join the conversation. Call in at 614-8980. You can also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. If you've got observations about the EPA, and if you think that's gotten too powerful, or do you think that it is a possible savior to change the course of climate change in America, give us a call. That number is 614-8980. So, Mr. Mintz, let me ask you one thing that you point out in your book is that public communication matters, and that one of the great challenges of the environment EPA is that they've got to get public buy-in on what it is that they're trying to accomplish. And someone should write a book about that. What is it that they're not doing, that they need to be doing? But why is the EPA having such a hard time selling what they're doing, what they have?
Okay, well, I think there are actually a couple of reasons for that, David. One is that EPA is somewhat limited by law in what it can do to publicize its regulatory changes and environmental problems around the country. It can't. It's very limited in the amount of public advertising that it can do, and its resources are quite limited by the budget that it has from Congress. So for those reasons, it tends to do less than it might otherwise in terms of publicizing its activities, both in terms of the standards that it sets, and also the enforcement activities that it engages in.
So let's look back on when President Nixon penned the documents to create the EPA. Why did he do that?
Well, that was a very different time in the history of our country. The president was then planning to run for re-election in 1972. His what looked like the person who would be his principal opponent was Senator Edmund Muskie of Maine, who was attempting to make an important political issue out of the environment. It was a time when there was enormous public support for environmental protection. The state of the environment throughout the country was really close to disaster at that point. There were rivers catching on fire. The skies were clearly, visibly polluted by air pollutants. It was clear to almost everyone that some change was needed, and people were demanding it. And so the president responded by taking a number of steps to bolster his environmental policies. Creating the EPA was one of those.
Now, closing down the EPA is one of those targets that we hear from some political candidates. It was not one of Rick Perry's three in the oops moment, but it was certainly Ron Paul was saying he would close down the EPA. Why can't everything that the EPA does, why can't that be handled by the Interior?
Well, actually, the original proposal for EPA was to create a combined Department of Interior that would include pollution control as well as the more traditional conservation and land management activities that the Department of Interior currently does. It was going to be the Department of Interior and Environment, but the president decided not to go that way. mostly as a result of a speech that was made by the then Secretary of Interior, who criticized the president's Vietnam War policies, and Nixon decided that he didn't want to go along with the proposal that would have combined the departments, and so he set up a separate EPA from the Interior Department. Certainly, theoretically, it's possible. At this point, it's quite unlikely. EPA has been around for 42 years, and the way the statutes have been written, they write include a set of responsibilities for the EPA through its administrator, who is an appointed official approved by the Senate. And so as a legal matter now, there would have to be a lot of laws that would be changed to combine EPA and the Department of Interior. But EPA does, some things that many people in the society recognize as important, including protecting the quality of drinking water, avoiding the contamination of school buildings and the exposure of school children to asbestos, and just a whole host of things designed to protect the quality of the air that we breathe and the water that we drink and swim in and bathe in and so on.
Sure, we depend on, and when it goes bad, it would have a huge impact on our health and quality of life. Let me ask you, you talked about the administrator of the EPA. Right now, we don't even have an administrator for the EPA. We have an acting administrator. Why?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, the current nominee for the EPA administratorship was nominated by the president in May. She's been blocked through the actions of Republican senators for a period of 120 days as of this afternoon. And as of today, EPA has now been without a permanent administrator for 138 days, which is the longest period of time that a top leader has not been in place on a permanent basis in the agency's history. The objections to her nomination were...
And so the nominee is Lisa Jackson, is that right?
Yes. The nominee is now a woman by the name of Gina McCarthy. She will be replacing Lisa Jackson, who was the EPA administrator in the first part of the Obama presidency up until about 4 months ago. And she was, until recently, actually still is, technically, the assistant administrator for air and radiation within EPA, which is a high-level post that's involved with setting policy for mostly air pollution-related issues.
So right now we don't
Before
have
that, a... she was an official with the state of Massachusetts.
So we really are lacking a head boss man in charge at the EPA. We're going to get back into figuring out who is in charge at the EPA in just a second. We got to take a quick break here on The Source. We're talking about the enforcement at the EPA, High Stakes and Hard Choices by Joel Mintz. And you're listening to The Source on KSTX. We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 614-8980. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We've got the Keystone Pipeline controversy. We've got climate change happening. We've got concern about air emissions. We've got dead zones off the coast, off our coastline. There's a lot on the plate for whoever is going to be in charge at the EPA. Enforcement at the EPA, High Stakes and Hard Choices is a book written by Joel A. Mintz. He is a professor of law at the Nova Southeastern University Law Center in Davie, Florida, teaches environmental law there. Also the author or co-author of six other books on environment, sustainability, and taxes. And so why don't we have, I mean, right now we're already way into the second term, a person who is the head guy in charge at the EPA who can really, make things happen.
Well, I'm probably the wrong person to address that to. I think probably the Republican senators in the United States Senate would be the best people to address that to, and I'm not sure precisely what their answer is.
I guess the word would be politics.
Yeah, well, it certainly is about politics, and I think the real reason that they're opposing her is the positions that she's taken on climate change regulation as EPA's Assistant Administrator for Air and Radiation, and before that as a pollution control official in Massachusetts. There's been some talk about her occasional use of personal email to conduct government business. She's stopped doing that. She's promised not to do that again. I'm not sure that is truly what's behind the opposition to her. I tend to think it's more based on substantive issues and opposition to EPA generally, which is thought of by some conservative Republicans as being something that should an agency that should disappear, as you pointed out earlier.
Can the EPA operate satisfactorily with the way things are right now?
It can operate. It's hamstrung by the fact that it doesn't have a leader to represent it vis-a-vis the public, Congress, and the rest of the administration. It has an acting administrator who's managing as well as anyone can, I think, in that kind of position. And it does have a permanent staff in place and also a complement of appointed officials. But clearly, it makes a big difference to have someone in charge at the top. I don't think there's any doubt.
So in your book, you talk about how business men got on board, people who ran companies, and said, yeah, we need an EPA, and we understand that we've got to have a clean environment. Apparently, that's breaking down now. We no longer have that understanding because we have this obstructionist attitude to keep putting in a top administrator in an EPA. So are we changing our minds about the EPA politically in the nation?
Well, I mean, that depends who we are. I think clearly over time, the opposition to EPA from the business from some elements within the business community grew. That's something that happened over a long period of time. There's actually a very good book that just came out that I'm in the process of reading by a professor actually at the University of Texas Law School, Tom McGarity, that discusses the evolution of what he calls the laissez-faire revival. It's a book called Freedom to Harm, published by Yale University Press, and it does an excellent job of tracing how the opposition to regulation has grown, really, especially since the mid-1970s, but how it harks back to a great extent to the so-called Gilded Age of the post-Civil War period, really going into the first decade of the 20th century. It's really quite a fine book that I'd recommend to anyone. But that, I think that explains as well as anyone can why the opposition to EPA has become so strident and why it's increased so much. It's a good read.
Okay, we're going to go to the phone, the number to call to join the conversation. What do you think about the EPA? Has it gotten too powerful? Does it need to have more authority in order to get the job done? 614-8980, 614-8980. Tom has been waiting. Tom, welcome to The Source.
Hello, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about John Connally. You know, he's a good Texas boy south of San Antonio, and his influence on Richard Nixon. On the influence in get the federal government to help protect our health. I think John Connally, he knew a lot of people who drank water out of the San Antonio River. And at that time, he used to say, well, the solution to pollution was dilution. There was going to be a lot of water projects to help kind of create quality water downstream from San Antonio. But San Antonio kind of lost. It wasn't very interested in people downstream.
All right, Tom, we'll see what Mr. Mintz, Professor Mintz has to say about that. Go ahead, sir.
All righty. I'm not too familiar with the specific influence of John Connally, but I know at that time there were a number of people advising the president President Nixon, that is, to take a stronger stand in opposing water and air pollution. As I mentioned, this was a time when pollution was dramatically awful in the United States. It was horrendous, and San Antonio was not unique by any means in that way, and there have been improvements since. Although there's more to go, I'm sorry to say I just don't know specifically about then Governor Connally's input. I just haven't come across that in my work.
All right, back to the phones. Roberto is on the air. Roberto, welcome. Well, we lost him. So let me ask you, Professor Mintz, about the EPA enforcement. You said high stakes, hard choices. What are the hard choices?
Oh, gosh, there are lots of hard choices involved. Every case is different. The choices involve, very often the title of my book implies the stakes are high because there are costs involved for the companies that are involved. And the hard choices come in because EPA has to sift through many more cases than it can possibly handle, given the level of its staffing and funding. So it has to decide which are the worst cases in terms of the impact on the environment from what's being done, as well as what are the cases that are likely to have the most impact, either in setting precedents in court or just in terms of publicizing actions that have been taken against bad actors, so that those who are not in good faith or who might be tempted to pollute against the law would be deterred from doing that. And then in each case, once it's developed, there are technical decisions that have to be made about just how much pollution will have to be stopped, how much will be permitted to continue, if any, and then how long a period of time the company will be allowed to put in the pollution control equipment that's needed. So there are all these questions come up, and they differ from case to case, from industry to industry, and there are enormously complicated technical issues that arise all the time. So there are all kinds of hard choices involved.
Now, the EPA's style of enforcement has varied quite a bit over the years. How is the EPA trying to achieve its mission today, and why is that a good choice or a poor choice?
Okay, well, in the, what you say is correct, but there are certain similarities, even going back to the 1970s, in terms of the overall approach. What it tries to do, what its approach is usually characterized as a deterrent approach. It tries to find either companies or industries that are polluting heavily and take an enforcement action against those entities to sort of set an example to others and to create an atmosphere where violators will feel that they really have to come into compliance. I mean, that's the general approach. It does that through everything from administrative, through notices of violation, warning letters occasionally, but more often administrative orders, and which have to be enforced through the courts ultimately if they're resisted, and also civil lawsuits, and in the most egregious cases, criminal prosecutions.
Now, in Texas,
so it does a wide variety of things, and it's continued to do that over time, but the levels of its activity have waxed and waned with political trends and lots of factors that have affected enforcement work at EPA.
Now, Texas has run into a problem with the EPA, and the state has sued the EPA on occasion. They claim that this enforcement is a violation of states' rights.
Right. Yeah, well, that's been a problem that EPA has faced with Texas and with a few other states. It's sometimes often really ultimately decided in the courts. More often than not, though, there are non-public negotiations, quiet negotiations that go on, sometimes informally, between EPA and state officials where, without publicity, they try to work out differences, and more often than not, that's done. But there are some that are where they just can't come to terms, and it goes to court, as happened with Texas, and it's happened with the state of Ohio in the past, and a couple of other states. it's more the exception than the rule, actually, but sometimes those disagreements come up.
But the issue has been cross-state air pollution, that any air pollution that's generated in Texas doesn't stay in Texas. It might stay in Las Vegas, but it doesn't stay in Texas. So that makes it a federal issue.
That's correct, actually. And there's been a recent case. What recently happened is that the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to accept a case, the so-called Homer City case, where in a controversial decision, the D.C. Circuit sent back to EPA a regulation known as the Clean Air Interstate Rule, known as the Cross-State Air Pollution Rule, CSAPR, that replaced the Clean Air Interstate Rule. The D.C. Circuit sent that back on the basis that it was too strict because it may have required upwind states to reduce more than their fair share of downwind state air pollution.
And this is a case that we're definitely going to be looking at in the next Supreme Court session. It's going to be something that another monumental decision coming from there.
Absolutely. No question. Very important decision that will come down. And it's not clear how the court will handle the case, whether it will overturn the D.C. Circuit decision, which was a 2-1 decision in Homer City, or whether it will affirm the decision as being appropriate to upholding states' rights, or whether it will dismiss on some technical ground like political.
Sure, you never know what they're going to do. But still, it kind of fits in with President Obama's recent speech at Georgetown about cutting back on coal-fired power plants emissions.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. President Obama said a number of things about cutting back on carbon emissions. He pledged to encourage the use of energy and so on.
Professor Mintz, thank you so much. We are out of time. You're the author of Enforcement at the EPA, High Stakes and Hard Choices, professor of law, teaches environmental law. And this is The Source on KSTX. We're going to be right back talking about the affordability of college.